This is Freedom Fiends broadcasting from Pod Bay 2A, a mile above sea level, intergalactic prairie studios. We alter your locus aurelius by warming your synapses with regenerative radio waves. This warms your brain to a tasty and toasty 365 centimeters Fahrenheit to keep a sin flood of statism out of your head. Can you feel it? Is it working, Phil and Jeremy? Can you feel it?
Oh, yes.
I think it's in my elbow this time. I don't know.
Take some ibuprofen. That'll help. And the Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. So we didn't really do a show prep before we got started. We kind of bickered back and forth and did an excessively long sound check to where we figured out that Jeremy is always way too loud. Phil bounces between quiet and louder, and it doesn't get louder when it gets louder. And I'm just, well... I'm me. But anyway, so do we have anything that we want to talk about right out the gate? Do we have any information that we want to share? I think I'd like to talk a little bit about the Liberty Fest coming up.
Well, that sounds like a wonderful idea. I would like to talk about that as well. So we should go there, Lou.
Okay, absolutely. Let's. So anyway, the Michigan Peace and Liberty Coalition is proud to present the 5th Annual Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest, which will be held at the Circle Pine Center in Delton, Michigan, June 22nd through June 26th. That's Thursday, June 22nd through Monday, June 26th. Liberty
Five
Fest
days.
Is getting longer and stronger. Yeah, it's not getting shorter, it's getting longer.
Yeah.
So I know other festivals are becoming flaccid, where Liberty Fest is...
Nothing worse than a flaccid festival, though.
Yeah, yeah.
I tried to refrain from the that's what he said joke.
So anyway, yeah, Liberty Fest is growing and coming into its own finally.
Awesome. Well, as I stated earlier today when somebody asked that question, as long as my current situation allows me to, I plan on being there. So I look forward to getting to see you and everybody else again. It should be a lot of fun because I know a lot of new faces are going this year, too, that a lot of friends of mine that I've made over the past year or two that weren't there last year that I'm finally going to get to meet. So.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. I did a little bit over an hour-long show last night with Paul Gordon on one of his 634 video podcasts.
Yeah.
I think that's how many he has going on separately. He's pretty darn busy. He's the busiest man in podcasting. He's the James Brown of podcasting. That's how busy he is.
James Brown of podcasting. He's going to eat that up. You know that, right?
Yeah.
So you're saying he does podcasting in the hot tub?
Yeah, and he screeches in a high voice, too. But anyway, so I got a chance to talk with him, and it was like an hour and 15 minutes, and a good hour of it was actual promotion discussing what goes on at Liberty Fest. And some of the featured guests this year are going to be Jeffrey Tucker. I'm pretty sure most people know who Jeffrey Tucker is. And he's always fun to listen to, especially when he starts talking about technology and how it's going to impact the future, and he just really, really gives me an optimistic feeling. When I get done listening to him, I want to go buy electronic gadgets to make the world a whole lot better. So,
see, usually when I listen to Jeffrey talk, I get a craving for McDonald's because he talks about his love for McDonald's a whole lot.
Yeah,
McDonald's, whiskey, and iPhones.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of Jeffrey's. She just always manages to work that in.
Yeah, McDonald's and iPhones, not so much, but whiskey I like.
Yeah, that's so. All right. I'd rather have some tequila, but that's just me. But that's exciting, though, because it was a lot of fun last year, but there wasn't like any like huge names in the Liberty community other than,
Prop
I guess,
CJ.
Us. Oh, this is true. You know what? I totally forgot. Shame on me. Shame on me.
Well, I'm having bourbon for midnight snack right now.
Nice.
Just bourbon for breakfast. Because I rarely drink, but I do enjoy a Jim Beam and Coke. I love the taste of it. There's like a non-alcohol version that wasn't full of sugar and crap and stuff like that, I'd probably love it. So if there was like a flavored water, a naturally flavored water that was like bourbon and cola, I would be just in like hog heaven. I'd be in like future bacon heaven.
And if only there was a non-sugar, non-alcoholic version of this sugar-filled alcohol drink.
Pretty much, yeah. But anyway, I was at the I was at the local grocery store. Yeah, I was at the local grocery store not too long ago, and I bought these little airplane-sized bottles of different types of Jim Beam. I guess like all these different whiskey companies, Jim Beam, Jack Daniel's, they're coming out with like the cinnamon version of their whiskey.
So
kind of like the Fireball, and I really like the cinnamon. The honey Jim Beam was pretty smooth. I was able to drink that without. Without, you know, sip on it without my face crinkling up from, strong. The black cherry is really good. Matter of fact, that's what I'm having right now is the black cherry with Coke. So it's kind of like having a cherry Coke. Mm. So this is something that tastes so good. It's so mild that I could probably drink a bunch of it and I'll just be loopy by the second half of the hour. But
excellent.
Yeah.
See, and so. I feel like such a lightweight. I'm drinking black cherry, but it's black cherry seltzer water because, you know, I'm a good boy like that.
Well, good for you.
I stopped drinking for the most part when I went paleo a couple of years ago. And even though I got off that diet, I just never really went back to drinking. Like, it's a rare occasion. I think I've had a couple of beers recently just because I had one sitting in my fridge for a long time that I had wanted to try at the time. It was some banana bread beer, which was actually delicious.
Oh, that sounds awful.
Oh, it was delicious. And it was like, you know, 8% alcohol. So it was like, you know, one nice... pint got me feeling nice because I don't drink anymore.
That's a meal. I went out camping on the final weekend of April, and I took a couple of beers that were left over from I think before Liberty Fest last year. Those were my last two beers, the six pack that I took out there. So, but anyway, yeah, Jeffrey Tucker's going to be there. Dana Martin, and I still haven't done a whole lot of research on her yet, but my understanding is she's a homeschooler, peaceful parent.
Peaceful parent and radical unschooler, I believe, is the way she's touted. I'm a big fan. I found her actually shortly after my kids were born. It was kind of how I got into that whole part of the movement. She's been interviewed. I've listened to a bunch of her interviews and stuff. She's I really enjoy her, and I'm looking forward to hearing her because I haven't got to hear her Jeffrey. I got to see live last year at Porkfest, but this will be the first time I get to see her speak live, so that'd be pretty cool for me.
Yeah, I think I've heard one or two of her presentations in the past, but anyway, and there's going to be a handful of fiends there. You get to meet these great celebrities like the punk juvenile delinquent Nick Hazelton.
Oh, that's right, Nick's going to be there.
Yeah,
riding their own yak back.
I don't know.
I think he wussed out on that.
Yeah,
I think he's taking a plane again. The big baby.
Yeah, that would I'm be so like too much work. It would be almost as much work as staying up to do a evening time podcast.
Right. Because anyway. It's past his bedtime now, so he can't handle it.
So anyway, and Randy Anglin will be there. So there's a fiend that's worth meeting.
Yes. Got to meet Randy last year. Had a lot of fun. So
yeah, Randy's a hoot. I really like him.
Yeah,
and you keep name dropping, talking about how great this camping trip's going to be, and I'm just over here really disappointed that I'm not going to make it.
Well, Phil, you know, these things happen.
Yeah, maybe next year.
Hey, I'm just unfortunately it's not even a definite for me yet because of my situation. I'm hoping it's going to be, but I'm going to try everything to get there because, you know, I mean, I'll get another vacation this year, and what better way to spend it than hanging out in the woods with a bunch of crazy anarchists and eating lots of bacon.
Eating properly cooked bacon that was cooked in cast iron. It was bacon that was fried in a cast iron skillet.
Yeah, I'll just whatever.
Instead of baked like those Nazis are.
I'm not bringing my oven with me, bakers. Lou. So I'll stoop to have your fried bacon.
You'll stoop.
If you bake your bacon, get ready to be punched by Antifa. Is that what you're saying?
Hey, listen. If I don't, if I'm not the one cooking and cleaning it, I really don't care how it's made as long as it's good. I just prefer to bake it when I'm doing it myself because it's an easier cleanup.
So yeah, it is going to be a real good time. There's going to be some really interesting people coming out there. Just from the folks that I know, they're coming out there, and I like you were saying, there's there's a lot of our friends, our imaginary friends from the internets. All these ones and zeros are going to be 3D printed into real life human beings that we'll finally get a chance to meet. And that's always one of the most exciting parts.
Yeah, definitely. You know, are you going to be doing any workshops this year?
What's that?
I said, are you doing any workshops this year?
I don't know.
I know your first one. Didn't your first one get rained out last year during
No. The first one was the fly fishing lessons.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And that, like, trying to teach people how to fly fish is not one of those things that you can take an hour and teach a handful of kids. It's really not the easiest thing. It's one of those things that you really have to be one-on-one all day long, and particularly if they're not getting it. So, electric shock collars probably help a little bit to break the bad habits before they really get settled in. But, that one was a difficult one to teach. The improvised fire starting, that was when the monsoon hit.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of, yeah.
Yeah, and if people didn't have their water wings with them, they couldn't get from one side of the campground to the other. Because that's almost how much it rained. I might be exaggerating a little bit.
No, it was bad. It poured for like at least 6 straight hours.
It poured. It poured hard too. But anyway, yeah, go to mplfest.org and get yourself registered. Get your family registered. Bring your friends and family. If you see strangers that look like they might want to come, grab them up and bring them with.
Yeah, you guys doing anything this weekend? No, come along. It'll be great.
Yeah, pick up a serial killer at the truck stop and say, hey, you want to go to a festival? Yeah, sure. No, leave the serial killers at home. We don't need any cops there. But anyway.
Oh.
So anyway, it's going to be a good time. Everybody get on out there and enjoy yourselves and all that stuff. So anyway, we'll be back in a couple minutes. And we'll start talking about other stuff.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
Well. Burf.
Freedom Fiends, and we are back. So there was a story that Michael had come across, and he asked us to cover because he didn't think he was going to be on tonight, and he might still interrupt at some point or another. We're not sure if or when that's going to happen, but it's always a possibility. But anyway, there's something going on with the NSA. What's up with that? They've created their own Gollum.
That's a good way of putting it. This particular story is from the Washington Post, you know, which is such a wonderful, wonderful organization. The headline is NASA officials worried about the day its potent hacking tool would get loose. Then it did. So this is about the recent revelation about, what is it, the Eternal Blue was the hacking tool that they essentially had used on, the NSA had put like backdoors into Microsoft. And the opening line of this is great, because the opening line of the opening very short paragraph, it's like just basically one line. When the National Security Agency began using its new hacking tool called Eternal Blue, those entrusted with deploying it marveled both at its uncommon power and the widespread havoc it could wreak if it ever got loose. So they knew, like, what, you know, it's one of those things like you can't get into the wrong hand, you know, just like any of those movie tropes with, you know, the powerful weapon trying to keep it out of the evil people's hands. Well, they go
which
ahead
mean, use, which is a guarantee that it's going to wind up in the wrong hands. Well, it's already in the wrong hands because the NSA has it.
But well, I mean, yeah, anyway, so wronger continue. Hands, I guess. And it even says that, you know, some officials even discussed whether the flaw was so dangerous that they should reveal it to Microsoft, the company whose software the government was was exploiting, according to former NSA employees who spoke on the condition of anonymity given the sensitivity of the issue. So this was like 5 years ago. And despite those warnings and despite people within the organization worried about what would happen, they just kept using it. And now there's just been these massive breaches that have all been coming to light recently. And, you know, now, you know, was the latest one was the WannaCry virus that went out that essentially was creating, I guess what was happening was it was encrypting people's systems and then charging them a ransom to get their
ransomware.
Yeah, ransomware. But the particular this was called WannaCry was the virus, you know, aptly named, obviously. And you know, so this is the brilliant NSA and all the you know money they've all the extorted money they've used over the years in the name of safetiness, creating things that are now being used against private citizens. Although I think the list of people that I saw hit were there were like it a lot of it didn't happen a lot in the U.S. A lot of people across the world got hit, including I think one Russian government agency and something in Brazil too. But also private citizens across the world all got hit with this. And it was the fact that this information when this information was first leaked, the shadow brokers, was that the name of those people that leaked this stuff originally? They leaked not only like the tool itself but like the exploits. So people like essentially me, idiots with a computer, would be capable of using this software to mess with people.
And, so they made it caveman simple is what you're saying.
Exactly, yes. You know, even a Luddite like me could destroy your world with a couple of keystrokes.
All right. Well, maybe the two of us are not the right ones to talk about this because I'm a bit of a Luddite also. So what it sounds like is the NSA actually created this ransomware that is in Microsoft, or is it just helped to enable it?
Not the ransomware. Well, they didn't create the ransomware. They created the backdoor that the fault in the software that the ransomware took advantage of.
Yes, that would be more accurate, okay. I believe. Yeah, so they basically, well, in the article, it talks about how they basically what the people who got a hold of this, what they just built upon what the NSA had done and turned it into a more potent weapon to be used right away and disrupt a whole lot of things. I mean, there's been things going, you know, websites going down for days now. Just a lot of what's the word I'm looking for? Not manipulation. Oh, it's getting late already for me. Just chaos. You know, that dirty word, chaos. Just a lot of chaos being run all over the place because of this. And again, it's thanks. You know, thanks government.
But I was told in high school that anarchy means chaos.
Yeah. No. Government means meow. Chaos.
We will be back with some funny quips about the government.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
Freedom Fiends, and we are talking about the NSA opening up the door for hackers and hooligans to get in there and mess with the internets and just really make things bad. Now, it's funny because people always talk about, well, the government needs to do something about this. Well, they did. They created a problem. They always talk about how we need to be protected from these foreign threats that are going to get in there and hack the American internet systems and just get into the Pentagram computer systems and the White House and all these different corporations and everything. And they're just going to wreak havoc. And it turns out that it's the government, the same government that people want to solve this problem, that is, one, incapable of stopping it from happening, and two, also enabling it to happen. And as you mentioned, Jeremy, they've made it caveman simple so that the common Luddite is able to become a super hacker. So I guess that's probably the one education win for government is they made super hacking possible for dummies.
They failed at that too. It wasn't them who did that. It was the hackers who got a hold of it that made it simple enough for anybody to use it.
My favorite part of this article too is in quotes. This is from the Pentagon cybersecurity official. NSA identified a risk and communicated it to Microsoft, who put out an immediate patch. Right. The NSA communicated it. What was that, the hacking group that you mentioned before?
The shadow brokers?
Yeah, the shadow brokers, right. Yeah, the NSA is the one that brought this to light, not the shadow brokers.
Yeah, well, Microsoft, I mean, as far as I know, Microsoft did. They had a patch up and ready to fix, you know, to plug those holes as soon as this all came to light. But because the NSA had the information and knew they were creating this giant vulnerability and didn't say anything for years, Microsoft could have closed this off, you know, could have closed it off years ago if they had been, you know, notified. But no, the NSA waited to tell them to confirm. Well,
if the NSA got Microsoft to put this backdoor in, then they should have been notified about it. They should have known what was going on.
Well, I want to clarify. So the software itself was like the NSA created the initial virus. So it was sort of the kernel that was the exploit. And I'm pretty sure that they're, you know, I don't remember if this was confirmed or not, but we know that the NSA and the Microsoft are probably communicating to have backdoors that are allowing for these viruses to exploit the system. But it was the actual kernel software that the NSA created. And what the crybaby virus?
WannaCry virus.
The WannaCry, right. What the WannaCry virus guys did, they actually took the software that the NSA made and created their own ransomware out of that.
Yes.
So it was, they used the NSA source code and built on top of it to create the WannaCry virus.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They're the ones who created that. Like, they made it so simple between that and the fact that the exploits were put out there that anybody who could just look at it and figure it out, you know, even an idiot could go, oh, wait, that's how you do it. All right, I can do that.
Right.
Me personally, if this backdoor is put into Microsoft, and from what I'm gathering of what you're saying, it sounds like it wasn't put in directly by Microsoft. It was something that got added down the road through viruses. Am I correct here, Phil, or am I just way off?
Well, the software was, so there's a difference between like putting in purposeful holes in the security and creating the actual software that takes advantage of those holes. So the NSA created the software that takes advantage of it. At least this is what I'm assuming. Assuming this whole creating the backdoors in the first place is happening, which I believe it is. But the NSA created the actual virus software without Microsoft's knowledge.
Okay.
And it was hacking software.
To be able to get it in there would require Microsoft's knowledge. But here's the thing. If the NSA is putting these viruses out there, creating the software which opens the doors for all these viruses, it seems like Microsoft would know what's going on. I know that the software sends reports back to Microsoft on a regular basis, particularly if it crashes, but it shows performance reports and it provides feedback to Microsoft. And it seems like they might notice these things. Or am I off base?
I'm sure there's something built in the software that emulates normal performance or something. But although with the NSA, this is another hilarious part of this whole story. The government can't even get, you know, hacking right because the NSA's original True Blue software was nicknamed True Blue Screen because it kept crashing the computers that it was operating on. So they couldn't even get the surveillance done covertly because they were crashing the users' computers.
That's what I'm saying. They screw everything.
Yeah.
So anyway, getting back to the idea of having a government provide security, and this goes back to like the Cold War era. The purpose of the KGB over in the Soviet Union, and then also the East German Minister for Staatssicherheit, Ministry for State Security. The key point to this, and also the Department of Homeland Safetyness, as well as the FBI, because the FBI was started off as a domestic spy agency, and aside from the rhetoric, really hasn't changed a whole lot. The whole purpose of that, it has absolutely nothing to do with national security, meaning keeping the people of America safe, of protecting the vital infrastructure and resources of all the people that live on this particular tax farm. It's not about actual national security. Just like the Stasi, just like the KGB, just like any other internal spy agency around the world, these organizations exist for state security. And that means to keep the government, to keep the state itself existing. Now, whether there are shadow governments and the deep state and all these little groups that are going to pop up in the event that something happens, you know, take all the most plausible to the craziest conspiracy theories out there. Whether that's true or not, it doesn't really matter. The whole purpose of this is to ensure that everything stays the same, to ensure that people stay under control and that the illusion of continuity, the illusion of stability continues.
Of course.
So, well, that's rant.
Good rant. I was just going to say, well, yeah, because, well, national security is simply a euphemism for Feinstein, we said so, that's why.
Mm-hmm. And they'll occasionally blame a foreign threat, but the guns are usually pointed inward rather than outward. That brings me to the story of the Golem. Now, I'm probably going to get some minor details wrong here. I'm going to try not to go into too much detail because I'm not a theologian. This isn't my thing. I'm not real knowledgeable on it. But the story of the Golem is that the rabbis of a village or a town way back a long time ago, back in biblical times, or before biblical times, because it's a Jewish story. The rabbis of a town created this thing called a Golem. And I'm gathering that it's like a little statue or something like that. And the whole purpose of it was to protect the people in the town. Well, it came to life and it started engaging in all sorts of antics. And just like the government protector, it went off and it became a monster. So in order to create a protection, they actually create a monster. And when it was a monster, when it actually became a monster, everybody was like, oh my God, I'm shocked. And it really mimics the warning in 1 Samuel 8 when the Israelites are demanding a king, and God says to Samuel, says, hey, go tell these clowns that if they get their king, they're going to get their king good and hard, and he's going to beat the dog out of them, and he's going to abuse them and use them for his glory, not theirs. Which is what politicians and government has done throughout all of history in the many incarnations of it. I mean, government has been around for roughly about 10,000 years, plus or minus a little bit. And with all the various experiments, all the little changes and different styles, and some things are extremely different from one to the next, and some are just minor differences. But after 10,000 years of experimentation in this institution called government, what you see today is the results of all that trial and a lot of error. That's what you have to show for 10,000 years of trying. So I guess my question would be, you know, how many more thousands of years and how many more mass graves do you want to fill trying to do the same thing over and over again and get that different result finally?
Well,
but that's just me.
You know, the right people, you know, those right people that we need to put in there, Lou, they probably haven't been born yet. That's the problem, Lou. We just have to wait till they're born.
Ever.
And
well, yeah, and it, don't think of it as 10,000 years of failure. Think of it as 10,000 years of waiting for just the right people to come along and follow the plan
practice,
properly.
Practice, Lou. 10,000 years of practice. Look at it that way. We're that much closer to perfection.
It should be a heck of a lot better. Yeah. So, yeah, I could just hear somebody, well, that's not real constitutionalism. So, yeah. Anyway.
You just didn't constitution right.
You just need the constitution harder.
Yes. Yeah.
I get a kick out of these people that will say, well, you know what? The Constitution's not being followed. To which I'll respond, okay, then what good is it? Yeah. It's not being followed. What good is it? Yeah, why are you putting your hopes on something that's not followed and so easy to not follow? You know, how is that any good? And
all
then they'll say, well, the
Constitution, dude.
Yeah. But they'll also say, but the Constitution has never been followed. Oh, okay, so what conclusion
Which
do you draw
it?
From that? Well, I mean, they'll say the Constitution is not being followed now, it's never been followed before, so obviously their answer is we have to get back to the Constitution. And yeah. One of my, probably my personal favorite is people say the Constitution has failed. The people failed. So not only are they blaming the victim, they're just completely ignoring reality, and they're also ignoring that if the people failed and not the Constitution, when things go well, that means that the people succeeded and the Constitution did not. So once again, the Constitution is completely irrelevant to failure or success.
Hmm. Well, that's just like logic, man.
You're getting your logic and my patriotism. Knock it off. All right, we'll be back. Meow, meow, meow. And worms.
Birds.
Meows and worms.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends, tasing you with liberty since 2011. Learn more at freedomfiends.com.
Back with the Freedom Fiends. This is Lou, and I'm joined by Jeremy and Phil. And this is a final segment of this hour. We're going to come back, and we're gonna carpet bomb you with knowledge. We're going to drop some mad scientists in the second hour. So you'll definitely want to be here for that, because it's going to be very inspirational and talk about accomplishment, which is something that we try to do here at the Fiends. This is the show that, when statism is dead and gone and government is only taught in history class, this is the type of radio that everybody will be doing, talking about accomplishment and things like that. So now we have to talk about getting around the state to do that. But anyway, so Phil had an interesting little topic, and this idea, I've heard a number of people talking about it, and I find it to be completely horrible. It's not well thought out. So, Phil, bring us up to speed on this foolishness.
Yeah, it's completely insane. So this is something that's been sort of growing in the quote-unquote libertarian movement. And generally, of course, it's people who don't really have their principles together. But a YouTuber named That Guy T, I don't know if you guys know him. Have you guys heard of him?
Yeah.
No.
Well, he's
nothing silly comes from YouTube,
right? I'm a fan of him at least I used to be, but he's been pushing this sort of libertarian allying with fascists narrative, and for the most part he was trolling, but recently he made the statement, well, here's the logic behind why this is true, and you know, I've pretty much convinced myself, even though I was just trolling. So I kind of want to say he's still just trolling. What was that?
So another one bites the dust.
Right. I kind of want to say that he's still just trolling, but some people might actually take this idiocy seriously. So
does he take this idiocy seriously? Do you really think he takes it seriously, or is he just like uber trolling right now?
I'm, like I said, I'm going to assume that he's still just uber trolling. I don't know. Okay. I'm not sure.
Did the NSA open up a back door that made him a super troller?
Right. Yeah, it's like the I forget that concept. There's a principle that you don't know if somebody online is being serious or not because the world is just that ridiculous. But anyway, one of the points he makes is that communism is against private property norms, but fascism can support property norms. And he sort of goes into this picking and choosing word games. It's the same thing that this guy Christopher Chase Rachel did. Rachel's,
and the gold medal for the mental gymnastics in the Special Olympics goes to
right, exactly. And Chase Rachel's, he posted this thing being supporting nationalism, and his whole shtick was, well, the dictionary definition says this, but he didn't even pick the same dictionary for nation and nationalism. And yeah, if you it, actually,
matter, he went for the most obscure reference that he could use for nation, a group of people. How many people refer to a nation as like a group of like people without the government? unit. I mean, a nation is a political unit. It's,
right.
It's just Feinsteinery. But anyway, continue.
but that guy T basically used the same thing, same idea. He said, well, fascism doesn't necessarily imply a state, and fascism supports private property norms, and so does libertarianism. Well, okay, no. Fascism Therefore, means a yeah. state. Fascism, by definition, is strong nationalism, a strong nationalist state. So
yeah, I believe Mussolini even defined fascism as the marriage of corporation and state. Now, yeah. And you could have variances between whether the state is on top or the corporations are on top, but it is a marriage because they need each other. It's a symbiotic relationship because they can't do all the looting and pillaging by themselves. They need each other to be more efficient in the looting and pillaging.
Right. But a state, by definition, does not support private property norms because it steals to survive.
Right.
And there were a bunch of little points that he made that were just very shallowly thought out. I don't think shallowly is a word, but
it is
they
now,
were thought out in the most shallow way possible, I should say. And they were very easily hole poked. You could easily poke holes into them. But...
Wow. And we might just do that for a couple minutes when we come back in the second hour. See you in a little bit.
Worms.
Or talk to you in a little bit.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Don't go anywhere. Like an NSA software that lets you see through the rain.
Wars. Freedom Fiends, broadcasting through the Libertarian Reeducation Center's low orbit ion cannon, high atop Financial Beast Plaza on the artificial satellite Lid Pair 2017 and the Alpha Centauri region. Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org. So,
yeah.
We left the first hour talking about a really stupid idea, and I want to touch on it again for a couple of reasons, because one is going to, it needs to be addressed, but two is also going to lead us into our topic for hopefully the whole second hour. Hopefully we'll be able to fill the whole thing up with some just wonderful goodness and dropping mad scientists on you. And it's the notion that libertarians should seek out an alliance with the alt-right. So libertarians, people that believe in liberty, people that actually believe in private property, people that believe in the non-aggression principle, meaning that you should not use aggression, force, violence, coercion as a method to achieve political, social, or economic ends. That you should not use the aggression of government on other people. And the people that are libertarians that, you know, allegedly subscribe to this idea are saying, hey, let's get involved with people that use force, violence, coercion, aggression, and all this other stuff. Because, well, we hate the left more than we hate tyranny.
Yeah.
Well, that's ultimately what happens. So
this goes back to that repeating the same thing over and over again, getting different results, because this is the same exact thing that the Libertarian Party, which I don't like to even call libertarian because of what they are, but the Libertarian Party.
I call them political libertarians, which means washouts from the Republicans and a couple Democrats.
Right. But what they've been doing this ever since they started. They've been allying with whichever side they think is going to be the most politically expedient or the most supportive of their ideas. So back with, I mean, even Murray Rothbard tried this. Murray Rothbard was
I wanted to tear him apart because he's an idiot about this stuff.
Right, yeah. And he would ally with the left at one point because they were against the war, so he allied with them. And then at other times he allied with the right because they had the better economic policies. But all that happened was that the side that you allied with used you up and threw you away. Exactly what you thought you would be able to do with the much larger demon that you're allying with, they're doing it to you. So what makes you think that you're going to suddenly be able to pull this off and come out ahead? It's
exactly lunacy. And one of his really, he has two really, really major faux pas that I'm going to mention here. The first was during the Vietnam War, and libertarians were opposed to the Vietnam War because, of course, they're opposed to war, especially aggressive, non-defensive wars, which Vietnam was. It's not like the Viet Cong were going to get in their sandpans and paddle across the Pacific Ocean and invade California and take away anybody's right to vote. All right, nobody's freedom was in danger because of North Vietnam. So Murray has this idea that, hey, if we partner with SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, and for those of you that don't know what Students for a Democratic Society were, is they wanted communism. They wanted stato-communism. They're not anarcho-communists. They're stato-communists. They want the North Korea, or the North Vietnam, the North Korea, the Soviet Union, the Communist China. That's what they want. They want communism. But
it's not communism. It's democratic communism.
Okay. That's not a mass grave. It's a democratic mass grave.
Exactly.
It's not starvation. It's democratic starvation. But anyway, Murray's genius reasoning behind this was that, well, if we partner up with the communists on the war, maybe they'll support us when it comes to economic freedom. Really? And you know what? Maybe if you partner with the prohibitionists on the war, maybe they'll support you on ending the war on drugs.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. If you go to the teetotalers, they'll support ending prohibition of alcohol or repealing weed prohibition and all this other stuff. Yeah, that's real genius. So when people start talking about when they use the logical fallacy of appeal to Rothbard, and that's really what it is when you say, but Rothbard said this. This is Rothbard's idea. Well, I don't care if it's Rothbard's idea. He's a man, not a god. Same thing with Ron Paul. I don't care what Ron Paul says. It doesn't matter that Ron Paul said it. It matters if it's correct or not. It just because Ron Paul said it doesn't mean that it's going to be correct. Same with Murray Rothbard. Same with Ludwig von Mises, probably one of the greatest economic minds in all of history. They're all men. They are not gods. They make mistakes. They are fallible.
Yep.
Act accordingly. So Murray Rothbard has this genius idea, and people say, well, you know, Murray talked about doing this. Okay, well, let's look at another one of his alliances. And another one that comes out is he was one of the founding members of the Cato Institute. And Mr. Libertarian, as he has been named, very hardcore libertarian, and I think if he had his way, then you wouldn't have men's statism or anything like that. Well, the Cato Institute is beltway libertarianism. It's Republican light for the most part. They're a little bit more freedom-oriented than some of the other groups out there, but I mean, being the most freedom-oriented of the beltway groups is kind of like being the tallest midget in the circus. There's going to be one. It's nothing to brag about. It's not an accomplishment. So as one of the founding members, Murray got pushed out, lost his stock options, and I don't even think that there's a plaque to commemorate his participation and the things that he did to help promote it, you know, to build up the Cato Institute. He basically just got pushed out after he did his thing, which is what's going to happen to libertarians once they get involved with the alt-right. Because the alt-right is not gonna stick with them on civil liberties. They're fascists. They're gonna want to impose government on their supposed enemies. And when the Antifa or the commies or whatever it is, if those ever got taken care of, then they're gonna point their fingers in another direction. And eventually it's gonna be libertarians. But the pragmatists and compromisers, they never see this. You know, there once was a time where government had not infested every facet of human existence, but then the pragmatists got in there and started compromising away the freedoms that our forefathers did have.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's actually one of the funny thing is what you were talking about with the civil liberties. One of the arguments that I've seen made for this is the most, it's like, well, the libertarians are have this libertine contingent and they just want to live the way they want to live and do whatever they want to do. And, you know, we know that single motherhood has this and this detriment. And we know that you know, I don't believe you shouldn't do drugs or do this. So what you're saying is that you are abandoning your principles because people are living their own lives in a way that you don't like. Really?
Yeah.
Then your principles are completely useless. Then you were not principled.
Well, I was gonna say they didn't really have those principles. They just paid them lip service, and that's a lot of these people. Well, I was just gonna say, you know, and I've seen a lot of this, and that's why I said in the last hour when you first brought up that guy T, like my instant reaction was another one bites the dust, because I've seen this happen a lot where people start off essentially trolling, but then they start to buy this garbage, and they find ways to rationalize all of it. And Lou, you hit on it before it really comes down to the fact that they hate anybody that they perceive as a leftist more than they hate the state being in their way in any capacity. Mm-hmm. And everybody, you know, I'm a leftist these days. I've been called a commie more than enough times in the past couple of months because I don't follow their idiotic train of thought where they pick and choose to get to this, and like you said, they ignore everything that has already happened. There's like, that didn't happen before. No, that didn't go wrong before. No,
right.
So here's a thought to all these libertarians with strategic deficit disorder, those that think that they can get involved with the alt-right, and all right, let's say that the commies did get crushed. Okay, let's say that they got beaten back or who knows, maybe there was some sort of, I don't know, pill that, or some sort of thing that wiped away communism from the face of the earth. Okay, now what are you going to do with these alt-right Richard heads? Because you still got them. So partnering with the alt-right to bust up the lefties and get rid of the lefties, it's kind of like partnering up with rattlesnakes to get rid of a mouse infestation in your house. Because those rattlesnakes aren't going to care who they bite. And if all the mice are gone, you're still going to have to contend with the rattlesnakes. And the rattlesnakes are going to bite you while they're going after the mice, too. So, congratulations, you have created a golem, just like people did when they said, hey, government should protect us. So, you so-called libertarians are using status fallacies to create your own problems, even worse than what they would have been had you done nothing at all. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. And the worst, it's even worse because a lot of the people that start out with this ally mentality, well, let's ally with the right or the left or whatever, because you see the same thing happening with like the mutualists, the anarcho-mutualists that have sort of abandoned free market principles to attach themselves to this quasi-social justice ideal, and they end up just sort of separating off into finally just admitting they're commies. It's the same thing on the right-wing side, where you have these people saying, well, let's ally with fascists. And lo and behold, a few weeks later, they come out supporting fascism as an idea. And a few weeks later, oh, that guy's a fascist now. So much for libertarian principles. They're not even lip service anymore.
Well, can they learn from the mistakes of government? Who thinks that it was a good idea for the United States government to ally with, I don't know, Osama bin Laden during Afghanistan in the 80s, Saddam Hussein in the 80s in Iraq, all these different dictators that got propped up in South and Central.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. Go to freedomfiends.com to help keep it drone-proof.
So the title of this episode is going to be "The Enemy of Your Enemy is Probably a Jerk Too." And it's quite fitting because people will just unthinkingly recite that phrase, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. No, the enemy of your enemy is probably a jerk also. And if you look at the alliances, and particularly the U.S. government, I can't count how many times the U.S. government has partnered up with people and regimes only to go back and topple them later on. Maybe sometimes it's deserved, maybe sometimes it wasn't. Maybe sometimes they got out of control and weren't doing what they were supposed to do, and then other times they were just no longer useful, whatever. But the bottom line is, if you're a dictator in a third world country, particularly with valuable resources, partnering with the U.S. Is probably more dangerous to your health than smoking cigarettes. It's not going to end well. It's not going to end well. So anyway, don't partner up with the U.S. government if you're like a third world dictator. It's not going to end well. So anyway, I want to switch over to more positive stuff. And Phil, you and I, we kind of broke this out a couple weeks ago, the last time you and I were on together. And we spoke about James J. Hill briefly. We didn't cover the whole thing. We probably could have talked an entire hour about him. And the reason that I wanted to bring this up was because we were talking about fascism. And I had mentioned that Mussolini had described fascism as the marriage of corporation and state. And a lot of people confuse an actual free market with the marriage of corporation state, cronyism. So I actually had somebody on the Face Beast recently tell me that we both have simultaneously crony capitalism and a free market. So at the same time, we have a completely free market, unregulated, unimpeded by government, where anybody can go out and hang their shingle and offer their wares. But we also have crony capitalism, where the government limits competition. So this is one of those people that gets the gold medal for the mental gymnastics. And not surprisingly, this person's a hardcore leftist. This person believes that without the big giant welfare system, that all these different charities that have fed people for all these years would not be feeding them anymore, because you can only do that with a welfare system. So anyway,
people have to be forced to give, Lou. They won't do it any other way.
probably her and her idiot friends would probably be that way. But anyhow, the article that we're going with is called "The Truth About the Robber Barons," and it's from Thomas DeLorenzo. He's one of the adjunct professors, or I can't remember exactly what his title is, but he's involved with the Mises Institute. And it's a very good article. He has a book out called "How Capitalism Saved America," and it's also based on, I believe, is Burton Folsom's from Hillsdale College, "The Myth of the Robber Barons."
Yes.
So I do want to start off with a little preface here. In his book, The State, Franz Oppenheimer, I know I'm repeating this, but for those who haven't heard it yet, in his book, Franz Oppenheimer said there's basically two ways of earning money out there. You can use the economic means, which means that you go out and you provide goods and services and you satisfy the customers, and people choose to voluntarily hand their money over to you in exchange for the things that you have to sell. Or you can use your political connections, the political means, to force people to buy your products, to eliminate the competition so that people have fewer choices and they're actually driven to buy your product. So to summarize that real simply is, your choices are work or robbery, taking care of people or being a parasite on other people.
And there's that John bad D. word Rock- again, Lou.
Well, that is the 800-pound murder dog in the room. But anyway, John D. Rockefeller, and he gets a very bad reputation. Now, in some cases, it is deserved. I know that under the Rockefeller Foundation has gotten involved quite a bit with government and has done a lot of things to manipulate things, and they have had the family has certainly been political entrepreneurs in many cases, but. He is actually a man of a lot of accomplishment, and we'll go into that when we come back.
Worms. capitalist worms.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
Other than that, it's been years since I've used it, and I haven't looked at it since I opened it up again.
That's fascinating.
Oh, well, account is completely secure, though. And we are back. Freedom Fiends, dropping mad scientists, carpet bombing you with knowledge and wisdom and all that other stuff. So anyway, yeah, we're talking about John D. Rockefeller. Now, Rockefeller is one of the founding members of Standard Oil, and he catches a lot of heat over the years for being a robber baron. But what you have to look at is even in cases where he did use government to his advantage, as a matter of fact, I believe he was an advocate of prohibition before the Volstead Act was passed for the purposes of eliminating alcohol-based fuels as competition. My understanding is that Henry Ford was working on an engine that would run on alcohol-based fuel, and to eliminate that particular competition, he used his political influence to support prohibition of alcohol. So, as a matter of fact, I think consuming alcohol was one of the minor reasons for actually having the prohibition of alcohol. But anyway, so regardless, even if he was strictly a political entrepreneur, meaning he made his money strictly because of government, he has an awful lot of accomplishments, which would mean that he wasn't specifically a political entrepreneur, because with all the favors that government can sell, and trust me, without the politicians having the ability to sell favors, you know, these lobbyists and corporations and politically connected people, there's no way to get these special favors without buying them from Congress. I mean, they can't just go write their own laws and say, okay, you have to buy our product. No, it doesn't work like that. They need the government to get these special favors. And one of the favors that no government can ever give is capability. They cannot provide an entrepreneur, somebody in business, with the capability of being productive, with the capability of inventing stuff that does not already exist. And that's really where Standard Oil did its best work, was coming up with new efficient ways of doing things. So in this article, it says, another prime example of a market entrepreneur whom generations of writers and historians have inaccurately portrayed, indeed demonized, is John D. Rockefeller. Like James J. Hill, Rockefeller came from very modest beginnings. His father was a peddler who barely made ends meet. Born in 1839, he was one of six children, and his first job on graduating from high school at age 16 was an assistant bookkeeper for 15 cents a day, under $10 a day today, even accounting for nearly 150 years of inflation. Rockefeller was religious about Rockefeller was religious about working and saving his money. After working several sales jobs, by age 23, he had saved up enough to invest $4,000 in an oil refinery in Cleveland, Ohio, with a business partner and fellow church member, Samuel Andrews. Now, most people can't even save up $4,000 today, let alone all those years ago.
I know, we're making that like that. That's insane.
Yeah.
They say he saved his money. Like, he really had to save, like, literally every dime to get there at that age. Yeah. But that's impressive.
And that's the thing. He was a tightwad about it. Like James J. Hill, Rockefeller paid meticulous attention to every detail of his business, constantly striving to cut his costs, improve his product, and expand his line of products. He also sometimes joined in with the manual laborers as a means of developing an even more thorough understanding of his business. His business partners and managers emulated him and drove the company to great success. As economist Dominic Armentano writes, the firm of Rockefeller, Andrews, and Flagler, which would become Standard Oil, prospered quickly in the intensely competitive industry due to the economic excellence of its entire operations. Instead of buying oil from jobbers, they made the jobbers profit by sending their own purchasing men into the oil region. They also made their own sulfuric acid, barrels, lumber wagons, and glue. They kept minute and accurate records of every item from rivets to barrel bungs. They built elaborate storage facilities near the refineries.
Say that on radio?
Yes. Yeah, a bung hole is actually the hole in a wooden barrel. So get your mind out of the gutter, gutter dog. Rockefeller bargained as shrewdly for crude as anyone has before or since. And Sam Andrews coaxed more kerosene from a barrel of crude than the competition could. In addition, the Rockefeller firm put out the cleanest burning kerosene and managed to profitably dispose of most of the residues in the form of lubricating oil, paraffin wax, and Vaseline. As far as like new inventions, new byproducts of crude oil, I mean, there were just so many things that came out of it. They figured out how to produce lubricating oils, gasoline, paraffin wax, Vaseline, paint, varnish, and about 300 other substances. About 300 other substances.
All off the waste of one product.
Yeah.
That they managed to turn into. They managed, like, that's in that, you know, especially, you know, want to talk about like the modern day environmentalists always complaining about waste and all this stuff. Look what this guy was doing back then before OSHA and all these other crazy things. The EPA was in place. This guy was doing it on his own and finding ways to get rid of it. And turning a profit. How dare he?
Oh my God!
Well, another thing that people just don't think about, it just doesn't really occur to them, is the importance of plastic. Plastic is one of those things that really makes your life.
Yeah,
it's everywhere, and it's essentially. I mean, it's used in, you know, to store food, to build appliances, to build, you know, computer systems and
cars.
Everything. It's everywhere. And
if it wasn't for plastic, the members of Greenpeace wouldn't have kayaks to paddle out to an oil well out in the middle of the Gulf to protest.
Checkmate.
Idiots. Go ahead, Phil. Continue.
I'm done.
It was way too early for a mic drop, Lou. Keep going.
one of my favorite stories about Rockefeller is prior to kerosene becoming so affordable, the price of it dropped immensely once they got in there and really started producing. Like it says here, they were able to squeeze more kerosene out of a barrel of oil. And I'm sorry, there's no political favor that will grant you the ability to get more kerosene out. You can't buy that favor. You can't scream at it to make the kerosene come out of a barrel of oil. You can't threaten it. You know, you can't make it work 20 hours a day to get it. You have to actually be smart and make it happen. So anyway, kerosene wound up being used in the oil lamps. But before kerosene, they were using whale oil. And the whale oil was just so darn expensive that the average person couldn't afford it. So when it got dark, you know, they had no way of really illuminating their home. You had candles, but candles really weren't that great. They don't compare to an oil lamp. So with whale oil being so expensive, average people, they just can't do it. But when you get kerosene and the price of kerosene drops like a rock, then you make it possible for the common man to be able to illuminate his home and stay up after the sun goes down, which in the wintertime it goes down pretty early. So they made life better for the common man. The price dropped, and he saved more whales by eliminating whale oil as a fuel.
He saved more whales than Greenpeace.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's like the flash drive, the little thumb drive has saved more trees than the EPA, Greenpeace, and every other government and private environmental group combined.
But the free market thing will never work, though.
Well, of course not.
It's a utopia.
Because we have a free market and crony capitalism at the same time. We also have tall, short people.
It's Schrodinger's economy.
Yeah. Exactly. Schrodinger's economy. It's both free and captured at the same time.
Exactly.
Yeah. People complain about regulatory capture while screaming about how horrible the free market is. Seriously?
Yeah.
This is why I don't support government-controlled indoctrination, education, nor do I support voting, because people are just too unthinking to be able to vote properly.
I want to make a connection on the innovation point that you were making. So there's a concept in parenting that's it's been pretty well proven that positive reinforcement is a much better motivator for good behavior than punishment. And the government really only knows how to use violence. That's all it can use as a tool in order to get anything done. And innovation does not happen through punishment. It can only happen through, you know, positive motivation. And the government cannot positively reinforce anything without punishing somebody else.
Yeah. And also, when you're, particularly with children, where they're constantly getting yelled at for misbehaving or for screwing things up, they're going to get to a point to where they're going to expect to get yelled at, and they're going to wind up screwing things up, because what's the point of trying to do well if you're just going to get yelled at? It's just like in under state socialism. What's the benefit of working hard if the slacker is going to make the same amount of money as you are?
Yeah, well, yeah. It's like that old joke in Russia. Three men are in the gulag. One they ask one why he's there. He says, "Well, I charge too little, and they pegged me for price fixing." Another one was asked. He said, "I charge too much, and they pegged me for exploitation." And the third one was asked. He said, "Well, I charge just the right amount, and they pegged me for collusion."
Yeah, that's also the Federal Trade Commission too.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. So that joke is told about them. But anyway, one of the harshest critics of Rockefeller and Standard Oil was journalist. Yeah, I'm gonna use air quotes there. Ida Tarbell, whose brother was a treasurer of Pure Oil Company, which could not compete with Standard Oil's low prices.
No conflict of interest there whatsoever.
Well, right. Anyway, she published a series of hypercritical articles in McClure's magazine in 1902 and 1903, which were turned into a book entitled The History of Standard Oil Company, a classic of anti-business propaganda. Tarbell's writings are emotional, often illogical, and lacking in any serious attempt at economic analysis. So, just like other leftist arguments. But even she was compelled to praise what she called the marvelous economy of the entire Standard Oil operation in a passage describing one aspect. I'll go into this when we get back. Worms, meow.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Woof, woof, woof. This sound is a woof.
Not sure.
Yeah, I don't know.
That sounds like that's a weasel.
So anyway, back to John D. Rockefeller. Not far away from, and this comes from Ida Tarbell's writings, and her brother was the treasurer of Pure Oil Company. So no bias here whatsoever. I mean, just because her brother is the treasurer of a rival company, she's not gonna bad talk them. But no, actually, in this, she's rather complimentary. Not far away from the canning works of Newtown Creek is an oil refinery. This oil runs to the canning works, and as the new-made cans came down by a chute from the works above, where they have just been finished, they are filled. 12 at a time, with the oil made a few miles away. The filling apparatus is admirable. As the new made cans came down the chute, they are distributed 12 in a row along one side of a turntable. The turntable is revolved, and the cans come directly under 12 measures, each holding 5 gallons of oil. A turn of a valve, and the cans are full. This table is turned a quarter, and while 12 more cans are filled and 12 fresh ones are distributed, 4 men with soldering cappers put the caps on the first set. The cans are placed at once in wooden boxes, standing ready after a 24-hour wait for discovering leaks, and are nailed up and carted to a nearby door. This door opens on the river, and there at anchor by the side of the factory is a vessel chartered for South America or China, waiting to receive the cans. It is a marvelous example of economy, not only in materials, but in time and footsteps. economy is not talking about the actual economy, but of looking for savings, of trying to do things, cost cutting and stuff like that. So really, Standard Oil became as big as they were by, one, cutting costs, but also in this article it talks about that they weren't afraid to spend money on innovation to get better equipment, to have a safer operation, because contrary to what the economic illiterates say, having injured workers is not a benefit.
Yeah, exactly.
If you don't have somebody in the bullpen that you can pull and put right in place that can jump into that job like nothing, without skipping a beat, having injured employees isn't going to work out. And quite frankly, if you have a lot of people getting injured, you're going to see fewer and fewer people going there. The people that are going to wind up working there are going to be the ones that have fewer options. But anyway, next up it says, because of Standard Oil's superior efficiency and lower prices, the company's share of refined petroleum market rose from 4% in 1870 to 25% in 1874 and to about 85% in 1880. As Standard Oil garnered more and more business, it became more efficient through economies of scale. The tendency of per unit cost to decline as the volume of output increases. This is typical of industries in which there is a large initial fixed cost, such as the expense involved in building an oil refinery. And one of the interesting things is the Standard Oil used to buy these other refineries, these places that weren't performing too well, or they could have been doing better, and they would hire them, or they would buy the places up, and because it wasn't a hostile takeover, it wasn't like they went in there and said, "All right, we're taking over here," and everything else. They kept a lot of the staff on hand, to include management. So if you went in and did a hostile takeover, you'd have to get rid of management. You'd have to get rid of a lot of the employees because there's going to be a lot of animosity. And there were actually some people that they made their living by buying up underperforming refineries or building new ones from the ground up and then selling it to Rockefeller. They made their money creating new refineries to sell to Rockefeller. But the only way that he can become successful, the only way that he can afford to buy all this stuff up is to go out there and innovate and do things the right way, to be better at it than everybody else. So when you have that type of person, why should I hate them? And if they become so dominant in the industry that you feel that they need to be broken up, why would you break up a company that is that successful?
Jealousy, man.
Yeah.
One of my favorite quotes from a teacher is, "Why do you hate rich people? I've never had a poor person give me a job."
Thanks for coming out tonight, guys, and thanks everybody for listening. For more Freedom Fiends, go to freedomfiends.com.
Worms.
Worms.